Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where I take you behind the scenes of downhill and enduro mountain biking and meet some of the characters involved in making this sport as great as it is. This episode is supported by PNW Components. I've been running a PNW dropper post for a year and it's the only post I've ever had that hasn't had issues in that time. This thing has always been bang on every time I hit the button, and what a button it is. The PNW Loam Lever is, in my opinion, the best dropper remote I've ever used. It's a super high quality machined lever with a nice big bearing to make it robust and a pad for your thumb so that you've got good grip. Again, after a year of use, through a British winter and a pretty similar looking British summer, it's still working bang on. They've got a new version of their Rainier dropper that is available to pre-order now. It's got a really simple adjustment system so that you can set it to the perfect length for you. They've also reduced the overall length of the post. I've got one on the way and it looks like it should enable me to move from 150mm drop up to 170, which is awesome. You can check out everything they have to offer over at pnwcomponents.com. And as a special treat for all you Downtime listeners, they're offering you 15% off during May using the code PNWDOWNTIME, all in lowercase, all one word, over at the checkout. This episode is also supported by the crew at Misspent Summers. Hopefully by now you'll be familiar with their amazing publications like Hurly Burly Book and the World Stage Book, which document the racing that we all love. These things are a great read, and clearly now is a good time to have good reading to hand. They've also recently created a zine library on their website, where you can download the zines for free and upload a zine that you've made too. There's some really creative and great stuff on there that you can print out and have to read for free. I particularly like the Cut Out and Play 2020 World Cup Season Top Trumps. That is worth it just for that alone. If that wasn't enough, they've got a ton of awesome t-shirts and other merch. They've got the latest Tommy C movie, Tea and Biscuits, which if you haven't seen it, then you really should. And they're adding a photography and print shop so you can get your hands on the work of their super talented photographers too. You can find all this on their newly revamped website, misspentsummers.com. And for you lovely Downtime listeners, you can get 15% off anything in the store until the 20th of May by using the code DOWNTIME15 at the checkout. That's the word DOWNTIME followed by the number 15, all lowercase, no spaces. All the links mentioned here will be on the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. To make sure you get your weekly fix of the podcast, then head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe, where there's links to help you subscribe on whatever platform is best for you. While you're at it, you should join our newsletter there to receive our weekly weekend warm-up email for a few bits of interesting bike-related stuff coming to your inbox every Friday. Thanks to everyone who's been watching my live podcasts over on YouTube. If you've missed any of them, then you can watch them now over at youtube.com/downtimemountainbikepodcast. This Wednesday at 8pm BST, I'm going to be joined by the founder of Cottick Bikes, Si Turner. We'll be chatting all things Cottick, and you can come along, join the conversation live, and ask your questions to one of the most forward-thinking people in the industry. So head to my YouTube channel now, make sure you're subscribed, and set yourself a reminder for this live chat. Our merchandise sales are still closed, and although things are starting to improve, our postmen and couriers are still plenty busy enough keeping us moving with everything we really need. But if you do want to support the podcast during these challenging times, then you can still do that with a Share the Love donation via downtimepodcast.com/shop. Donations start from £5 and go towards keeping the podcast going and helping me improve what I'm doing. Okay, on to this week's episode. It's taken us a while, but we promised you a part two, and here it is. Fabian Barel is back. Last time around, we chatted about the emotional and psychological side of riding and racing, so this time we decided to talk tech. Fabian has always been a rider who likes to get into the detail of things, and so when you ask his opinion on something, you know that it's been well researched and thought out. We talk about how far ahead of the game they were with the Sun team in the 90s, and why that level of technological progression wasn't seen for a good while during the 2000s. We get Fabian's thoughts on longer geometry, mixed wheel size bikes, and tyre inserts. So if you want some technical insight, then you need to give this episode a listen. Okay, without further ado, here's part two with Fabian Barel. Fabian Barel, welcome back to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Things are, I would say, brilliant so far, because we have a beautiful weather and everyone is healthy, and I touch wood, but we are in the middle of a lockdown period due to the COVID-19 that is quite epic. But as we are just saying, so we should keep positive and look forward, and hopefully we're going to get out of it pretty soon.
Yeah, fingers crossed on that one for sure. Well, last time we spoke was at Léger World Cup. We sat down and chatted for the podcast then, and we talked quite a lot about the the emotional side of riding, the psychological side of riding. This time I wanted to kick things off on a bit more of the technical side of things. And I think you're someone who people definitely recognize as a rider that was into that side of things. When did you realize that it was important as a racer to be involved in the product development side?
Well, I have to be honest with you that I went actually deep right in the beginning of my career into R&D, just by the fact that back in the days I was riding for a French brand called Sun, S-U-N-N, that it's a French brand that is not as known today, but really well known in the past, with one of the strongest team in the days in the late 90s. And this brand was actually working with someone that was called Olivier Bossard, that is actually doing now the Boss Suspension, B-U-S, mm-hmm. B-O-S. So you probably heard of it. And this person, and that is an engineer and was at the moment the developer of the Radical Plus, that was one of the most advanced bike in those time, actually brought us already a lot of info of what hydraulic into the suspension, about bike position, and also tire movement and flex and rigidity into the frame was actually bringing into our riding. So at the time it was really messy information, but as time went through, things become a lot more understandable and possible to analyze and transform onto the bike as the time went on through my career, as you can imagine.
Yeah. So what kind of things were you specifically working on back then? You mentioned a few bits and pieces. I've heard people talk about you guys messing about with spoke tension and all sorts of stuff back in that early 90s.
Well, one of the two main topic that we were working on back in the days was, I think we were one of the most advanced in terms of hydraulic, because we already had shocks that had two voice of placement of oil flow into the shock. Mm-hmm. And so we were one of the first one to do that, and also to really analyze properly the kinematic of the bike with a real motorbike link that we had at the bottom of the shock, to actually have exactly the compression ratio we were looking for and the wheel path as well. This was one of the main thing. And the other thing that was a key advantage at the time, when we were already working with Mavic, the Mavic wheels, we were playing a lot with the spoke tension for frontal and lateral rigidity, that at the time was already a big advantage, because it was a period where people were just looking at solidity and not necessarily at performance of the wheels. When we were, I think, at this time a bit ahead and already looking at what the wheel could bring us also in terms of just riding efficiency.
Yeah, so like you say, people were, I guess, looking at stiffness and strength of the product. And were you kind of coming back away from that and bringing flexibility in to see how it helped? Is that right?
Yeah, well, at this time, so if we're talking late 90s, we also develop a perimetrical frame. I don't know if you remember that bike, and maybe we could look for some photo to illustrate this, but there was two tubes on the upper part instead of the top, a normal top tube.
Yeah.
And this was actually bringing to the main pivot a real rigidity between the front and the rear of the chassis, which was really hard to have back in the days with those frames and the kinematic we were having. So due to that perimetrical frame, we had a lot of stiffness, lateral stiffness that was coming into the bike. And obviously, due to that extreme stiffness, you had too much terrain feedback into the rider. And this was obviously a certain help when everything was under control, but was also really rough when the bike was going from side to side of the track. So for that reason, we start looking for a certain flex into the wheel to be able to compensate this. And that's at this moment of my career that I start realizing that obviously there is different component on the bike, but the synergy you will have in between the all components is actually making the transfer of information coming from the terrain all the way to your arm and legs to get the best and the most supple feedback and understandable in terms of pure feeling on the bike.
Yeah. How far ahead do you think you guys were back then? Because I don't think many people were working on that sort of stuff.
Well, like at the end of the 90s, I think we were really ahead in 97, 98, all the way till 99. And then when we arrived into 2007, the brand actually bankrupt, and we got back into more of production bikes, less advanced. And at this point, it was only catching up. So for me, at the end of the 90s, we had 1 or 2 year, or maybe 3 year of advance on this. And Nico Vuillaz moved into CERN in 99, really surfed that and keep on using those technology also in his own bikes. That was a called brand V Process. Like mm-hmm. when he started to do his own bicycle, and all this was really, really advanced at the time. And it was one of the key part of the success. I think we were one of the first one coming from the French community, let's say, and the French Federation, linked to the brand with CERN that was at this time, managed by Max Commensal. Obviously the owner of Commensal Bikes today. There was a lot of dynamic under the professionalism that we wanted to have and the approach of racing. And I think at this time we learned a lot, and we were quite advanced compared to the others.
Yeah. And you were one of the first, if not the first team to be running data acquisition on the bikes back then as well. Yeah.
Yeah, you're totally correct. Like the first time I rode with a data acquisition was in 1998. Uh-huh. So I let you imagine everything that we've been doing back then. But again, we were really advanced, and we believed a lot into racing to bring into the market. But I think at the end we went so far that everything was very expensive and the company couldn't keep up behind this passion and behind the development that we had. That's why everything's been stopped. And let's say that at least during almost 7-8 years, it's been a lot slower in R&D than what has been advanced for us in 3 or 4 years in the late 90s, from my perspective.
Yeah. Can you remember what sort of stuff you were measuring with the data acquisition back then?
Oh, well, we were measuring brake pressure, brake temperature, obviously travel within the suspension, if I'm correct, and that's pretty much it, and accelerometer. So those were pretty much what we were. We didn't have at the time any sensors that had the capacity to measure the flexibility of the material. Not at the time.
Yeah, okay.
But we had certain measurements within the suspension, the speed of the suspension, speed of impact, terrain reading. All this was already happening.
Yeah. And was that data being used over a race weekend to help you optimize setup, or was it more?
No, it was more in
R&D process.
Yeah, it was R&D process. It wasn't as flexible as what we have today, just because, you know, data acquisition is one thing, but reading the data is another. And I would say that there is a lot of systems since a long time that are actually within the capacity to record the data. But having the software that are capable to analyze it, and second of all, capable to analyze it quickly is another step. And because you need to make it understandable for the rider, understandable for the mechanic, as much as it is understandable for the engineers. So all that process is actually taking time. And if you look today, I mean, we have a system now that we are capable to use and understand and use on the race weekend. Loic Bruni's got this capacity, but out of those two teams, there isn't many teams that are capable to do so.
You hinted at it before, but it felt like once that Sun team kind of came to its end, there was a good period where there was progress clearly, but there wasn't progress at the same rate that we saw in those few years with you guys. What do you think was driving that kind of lull in the sport? Because it feels like that is starting to come back now. There's a lot more experimentation and testing and data acquisition going on than there has been for a good few years.
Well, one thing that we have to know is that obviously everything we're doing into racing is driven by the impact you have on mass production and what transforms into sales for the brands. And I would say that within two racing, it's been a bit of a low when after Grundig and the World Cup was sponsored by Tissot Grundig and the whole dynamic there was in the late 90s, from 2000 on, like we lost a bit of a certain dynamic that we could felt or we could feel also coming from the brand investment into the global sport. And as we know, downhill is obviously the Formula One of racing, and it is a support of R&D, and the R&D is even more justifying the marketing investment. But if the marketing investment is not viable, it's really hard for the brand to simply invest in R&D and development there. And I think it is the same for Formula One. If tomorrow in Formula One is not on TV anymore, Ferrari won't invest that much money to be able to do the best car and the best technologies just for R&D. It's a combination of what he brings into image for a brand also as much as what he brings into R&D. So based on this perspective, this combination was not quite there during the early 2000s. And from there, it really took off when Red Bull got involved into the sport, when the global dynamic and the strong image came back into downhill. And this, I would say this actually helped the brands to pop up and invest back again.
Yeah, so it's money related at the end of the day. That money has to be available.
Well, that's the reason why Sun got down and stopped the vibe that they had. That's also the reason why also it didn't happen in the year 2000 because everyone was focusing on developing mass production products. And now that everything is more stable and we feel that we need to be advanced again and the marketing is positive again, then the money is reinjected into that direction. So we can really feel this, obviously, throughout the 25, let's say.
Yeah. And do you think teams are doing more testing away from the races now? I get the impression, certainly, the specialized gravity guys go down to New Zealand and do a lot of work pre-season. But do you think there's more general testing going on?
I think it was happening before, but not for everyone as much as it became now. There was a whole trend, and it's a large topic, but you know, downhill has always been a cool sport of cool attitude, or you win by talent, or you just go and come in, and you're just good, so you win. And I think this was the image, but behind the scene, all those people who was actually winning was really hard workers. I give you the example, for example, of someone like Sean Palmer. Sean Palmer always looked like the super talented guy that just does everything. Motocross, snowboard, downhill, he's been successful to everything. But what people actually don't know and don't see in his image is that Sean Palmer is a really hard worker. He's a huge talent, but he's a really hard worker for his goals. And I think that now, through the general image that we have, part of racing is also training, is also preparation. And the word is spreading a lot easier that you are committed to train, you are committed to the testing, and you're just working hard to achieve your goals. And this message has felt a lot more transparent or has felt a lot more transparent over the last three, four, five years than he has been during the last 15.
Yeah, athletes seem to be more willing to share that side of things, and teams as well, I guess, from a marketing perspective.
Exactly. And I mean, I was, Nico Vuillaz or myself were a bit looking like aliens towards the other because because we weren't ashamed to say so. And all that combination has been in a way a great satisfaction now, because you can see that what we were doing 20 years ago back then is what they're doing now. So, and we could talk about many aspects of the sport in this way. So this is a real satisfaction, and it's great, great to watch.
Yeah, definitely. What's Canyon's approach been to testing then? What sessions or kind of what pre-season work do you guys do as a team?
Well, it's really intense in a way that at the moment I'm trying to bring a lot to my riders. And obviously when I'm saying a lot, he comes from the mental aspect that we talked in the first podcast, but also all the way through R&D, through training. And obviously each individual is reacting or making an individual approach to each topic in a different way. And for me and for Canyon and for all the management that we are, we need to find all the time the right key to be able to let's say provide all the tools to our riders and for them to use it and pick it at the moment they want. And this is really a real adaptation because you can't just say that what works for you will work for them. You need to work with them and use your experience to provide them what will be best for them and not what is best for you. So that's in compromise is a quite a heavy commitment. We're trying to have the right amount of interaction because it's very easy when you have someone like passionate like me to overload them with information, with exercises, with things to do. So I'm really trying to find the right distance. Gabe Fox, the manager, is really helping me to be able to find the right way to drive the messages. And this is working, I would say, so far so good, especially on the R&D side where we've really built team now after 3 years of experience where you have teams of individuals that are really supporting each other. Like if you take the example of Troy, he came in with his mechanic Aaron and now we built Aaron and we support Aaron and he built himself also through different experiences that we had and tools that we provide him. And this give him the chance today to be fully independent when it's the moment to go to a testing session in Australia. And this is really key, I think, to have a certain success into the progression of the riders.
Yeah. So you guys are able to do testing in isolation in various different parts of the world rather than having to necessarily get everyone together for an organized team camp to try stuff out. Is that what you're getting at?
Pretty much. It's like we actually doing 80% of the work when we're together and they're going to fine tune the last 20% when they are on their own with those teams of individuals. Because obviously when we are all together, we are more than 10 people. You can imagine that it creates a certain inertia in logistic, but also in the way you draft the message, in the way you communicate with the people. So you need to find the right time to have a real relation, individual to individual, more than just team and group work. So it's a thin line to compromise to be able to use the strength of the group, but also build the individuals.
Yeah, interesting stuff. I wanted to talk a little bit with you about longer geometry as well from a development side of things, because I think you were one of the early, you know, protagonists behind getting bikes to be longer than kind of shorter stems and that side of things. Can you talk us through that a little bit from your perspective?
Well, there is two approach, obviously. There is having a longer bike has got the advantage, but also the negatives of it. It all depends on what you aim and what you want to do with your bike. Where I'm going there is that we start back in the days with 10, 26-inch wheels with fairly steep at angles. And I was looking one of the great posts that Rob Warner put from the early 90s when he's riding his bike. And Rob is like, what, 190 or 195 meter high? And he's got this tiny bike with super steep head angles, small wheels. and even Steve posted a video that was not so old, maybe 5, 6, 7 years back, just with the 26-inch wheels for his height. You look at him, you look like he's riding a BMX bike today. So back in the days, obviously, we have a lot of history into mountain biking that is coming through road cycling. Okay, we have still a lot of parts and a lot of components that are linked historically to road cycling, and geometry was also part of it. Back in the day, we had longer stem, we had flat bars, and all this slowly, obviously, changed as we understood that our sports had different needs. And the longer geometry, I mean, the whole story behind the longer geometry is to basically accept the fact that your bike can do a lot for yourself. In terms of stability and that it will actually avoid you to rebalance yourself on the bike permanently. If tomorrow I give you a small frame versus a large one in a straight line at 60 kilometers an hour, you will tell me, wow, Fab, for sure, the large bike is a ton more better than the small bike because the longest chassis is actually giving me a lot more frontal stability so I can go faster by doing less effort. And this is an evidence to everyone. But if tomorrow I give you the tightest switchback of the south of France, and I send you there with the large and the small, you will tell me, well, Fab, it's a lot easier to turn the small bike in that sharp corner than it needs to turn a long chassis. By this example, I'm explaining you that everything is a matter of compromise. It's a matter [S2] Yeah. [S1] Of compromise because it will also affect the handling of the bike versus what it's going to bring you in terms of stability. And this I quickly understood, with just to give you a little background story, is that when we had the Worlds in 2005 in Livigno, we had a track that was a 56 kilometer average per hour, a track that was really, really fast and dry. There was not many corners, one little section. All the rest was super fast. And we went there to do testing in June. And I was saying to Paul Walton, my mechanic at the time, I was saying, well, I'm fighting with the bike permanently. I'm moving my weight to the back when I'm hitting the brake. Every time I'm going really fast, I have to really load the front to not have my front rebounding everywhere. I'm really struggling there. And from there, we went slacker and slacker on the end angle. And at some point, the end angle got so slack. I was at 59.5 degrees, and the head angle got so slack that I was like, Paul, I can't turn the bike. I can't steer the bike. Yeah. So he's like, well, then let's make a longer chassis. And we that's at this point that we say, okay, let's bring back to 60-61 degrees head angle, but then increase the chassis length, increase the front center, increase the distance between your feet and your arms. And that's where all that story begin. And that's where we start playing a lot with the geometry, with the feet position, realizing that basically just the body dynamic could be a lot less and a lot more, and then a lot more efficient on the bike by having the right compromise of legs on the trails.
Yeah.
So from there, back in the days, we start on digging and analyzing things, and we also realize when we put the Montrager team together, that this was also being largely affected by the rider's height. And to take you another example, is that the example I gave you about the straight line and the switchback earlier is massively impacted as well by a rider that will do 2 meters or a rider that is riding 1.70 meters. So basically this, the height of the rider versus the terrain you're riding and the type of riding style you're doing is obviously massively impacting the frame and chassis size you will be choosing. And this frame and chassis size will also depend from the wheel size you are riding. If you're riding a full 29, a full 650B or an hybrid, obviously this will affect the global geometry and bike lengths you will look for. So
yeah,
coming to this, that's for me a great example of what racing can bring into the general market. Because if there wasn't people like all the great riders we know that are pushing their limits on the product, it wouldn't then become accessible for the general riders and general consumer. And and obviously that's part of the beauty of the sport. And back in the days, it's definitely been something that's been progressing. And we can see now lots of people riding 29-inch wheels. And you can see someone like Troy Brosnan, that is obviously World Cup, intense and very dynamic rider, looking at riding a large frame. He's on a large bike when he's 1.70 meters on 29-inch wheels. So it's showing you the extreme of where things can go or not.
Yeah. I was going to ask you your view on mixed wheel size bikes, actually, whether you think there's benefits to be had there. And if so, is it discipline specific? Is it specific to rider style or rider height? And have you had the chance to play around with that much?
So we did a lot of testing, as you imagine. 2 years back, we tested everything to try to understand what it was bringing. For my point of view is pretty clear: is that number one of your choice is the rider height. For me, anyone that is above 1.90 meters, 1.95 meters should be on a full 29-inch wheels. I'm giving you the example of a full 29 because what you need to know is that for me, on gravity sport, I'm not talking endurance sport, I'm not talking cross-country there, right? I'm talking for gravity sport where you're looking at handling of the bike and performance. It's like the 29 rear wheel is actually taking off a lot of your legs amplitude, because mm-hmm. for the simple reason that your butt will touch your rear wheel very quickly. So you're not allowed to flex your leg as much as you would need. So someone very tall won't have any problem. So for me, anyone above 1.90 meter is not a discussion, should be on the full 29. Everything below is really depending on what you're looking for. If you're looking at race, performance, gravity, and you know where you place your wheel, you know how to handle your bike, you know where you're going to accelerate, you know where you're going to brake, and you know where you're going to be pushing on the bike, then for sure 29 is more what I would call efficient. The full 29 is what's going to drive you speed, help you to maintain speed, help you to control your grip, and for sure the full 29 is an advantage. But the disadvantage of it is that you will be having issues of everything that is coming into anticipation. We all have this moment where we're riding, and suddenly we got scared of something. We hit the brake and we shift our weight towards the back. And the last thing you want is to be having your wheel, your butt on the back wheel, or to be kicked by the bike because the back wheel is pushing you out. So that's why, from my perspective, the hybrid is really to be considered for everyday fun ride for everyone that is below 1.90 meter. It is fun. It is really enjoyable, and it is quite dynamic. It's easier to manual and control. Yeah. Now you have a massive amount of difference of rolling. That's why if you take a bike, let's say that you go for enduro riding or normal trail riding, for sure the full 29 will be an advantage because the bike is more balanced, the bike is going to be rolling, and it's going to be more stable. But then if you do the exact same type of riding on an e-bike, where you don't need so much, and you will be having issue of maneuvering the bike due to the weight, having a smaller wheel on the rear is going to, number one, help you to have a heavier braking on the rear wheel because you will be transferring your mass easier towards the rear wheel. So you will be digging the wheel in to control a better braking. It will be easier to manual because obviously the wheel diameter being smaller, it will be easier to push and manual. Like we all have this experience of a full 29, not that easy to actually manual and put on the rear wheel. And the bike will be just easier to handle. So again, we're coming back to the same discussion that we had before, where it's a matter of a compromise between stability, efficiency, so pure time performance, versus maneuverability, agility, and fun on the bike. So basically, the discussion we are having on the wheel is actually having a similar consequences than what you would have on the chassis length.
Yeah.
So that's why this thin compromise is really hard today to say this is better than this. So please go for this. That's wrong. It will depend of your expectation and the type of riding you're doing. It will depend of your riding heights, and it will depend of your skills. And based on all this, that's how you're going to find the best compromise and choice of the bike you want to ride.
Yeah, it's a complicated mix. Would you ever think there's a circumstance now where you'd go for a full 650B setup? Like, is there a rider height or a style of riding or a level of skill that you think would benefit from that? Or is a 29-inch wheel on the front always the right answer?
I would say that you need to be very small for the 650B to be interesting on the front.
Okay.
That's the first thing. The second thing is if you're looking at, let's say, extremely playful bike. For sure, if you're not looking for grip, but you are looking like more playing on the, I don't want to say pump track, but like trails that are like just flowy and rolly, where you want to pump and accelerate and generate speed very quickly, then the full 650B is interesting. And if you are very, very small, that's why, for example, we did the current spectral in full 650B, because we had the aim of this bike to say, okay, that's going to be a very small trail bike, just playful. We're not looking at performance, but just very easy agility, very easy maneuverability, and just just fun to play and to ride. So this is the reason we made this choice. But I have to say that things now, except for very tiny people and tiny sizes, everything is going with a 29 on the front.
Yeah, cool. There's another technology trend that I'm interested to get your thoughts on, and that's tire inserts.
So that's a good topic. We have seen on the last 4 or 5 years a lot of things appearing, because obviously puncturing is the thing that we are all annoyed by, and especially in racing, when you know how tight it is now on the World Cup at the end, on the overall, how tight are the points. You definitely don't want a flat. So the tire inserts, it's pretty easy to understand. You basically adding material within the tire to protect what is happening between the tire and the rim itself. Most of the time, when we having a flat today in downhill or gravity, it's either a snake bite. So what we call a snake bite is obviously the side of the rim that comes in contact with the two sides of the tires. Mm-hmm. And you have the rock from the other side, and it obviously creates an edge that cuts the tire. And the second way to flat is because you're riding a low pressure, the tire is not suffering, but then it's the rim wall that is falling, and then you're losing your tubeless.
Yeah.
And you're damaging your wheel. So those are the most common, I would say, today type of flatting, because the zone in the tire, etc., now are solved by most of the tire sealants. So those two flats approach, we say we're going to add material into it. So you saw plenty of tire inserts coming in there. That was obviously limiting this impact, but also affecting largely the tire movement.
Yeah.
So you would have, I would say, let's put two categories of inserts. You have the full insert that is basically like a tube. It's completely round. And you put it into the tire and you close it. Or then you have other inserts that are going to be the one that are just going into the rim, at the small part of the rim, and will be just protecting the rim. So obviously the first one is having a larger volume than the other one, but the second one is having a lot more density than the first one. Are you keeping up with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. So basically, those two type of inserts won't have the same impact on the bike and tire function. But the boss aim of those things is to actually reduce the pressure. If you reduce the pressure on the first example, which is having something fairly round, bigger volume, but with a small density, will act just like a pressure, but will provide a lot of rebound into the casing of the tire. Because all of these inserts are modifying basically the casing functionment. And what you're looking at is to have something that is absorbing, but that is not actually changing the reaction of the tire. And what we are talking now is something that is also very easy to identify into different casing of the tire. I'm giving you another example, and I hope I'm not going too deep into explanation and in technical details, but you guys probably know that in a global casing, either you have a lot of layer all around the tire, or either you have what they call some inserts that are just in the wire beads. So it's just on the side for about a centimeter. So those two different casing have a similar effect than the two different tires inset that we mentioned. One is going to provide, they're both going to provide a lot of frontal suppleness and absorption, but one will control more the lateral flexibility of the tire when the other one will not.
Mm-hmm.
So the two inset, the first one will actually tolerate lots of frontal and lateral movement, when the second one, that is the insert that will be more into the rim with a higher density, will not affect so much the frontal flexibility of the tire, but block massively the lateral flexibility of the tire. So for me, the second one is having a lot more advantage than the first one. And generally, the first category of tire inserts are a lot heavier than the second one as well.
Because there's more of them, right?
Yeah, well, there is more of them. I mean, the density is not the same. So logically, it shouldn't be so much of a difference just in terms of math. But at the end, it is. It is.
Yeah.
But you're still looking at for a good tire and said 250 gram pair wheels.
Yeah.
Which is massive on rotating masses. If tomorrow you put 250 gram or even half a kilo above your bottom bracket, you will actually find an advantage to this. But if you put 500 grams into rotating masses, your bike will feel like it's 5 kilo heavier.
Yeah.
So that's why people are hesitating a lot at using it. And if you have a possibility to avoid it and just doing through the casing by adding, let's say, 100 or 120 milliliter of sealant, you still have a bike that works better from my perspective.
Right. Okay. So you would prefer to ride without an insert?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Because of the weight.
Yeah,
right?
Because the weight is affecting massively the handling of the bike. It's harder to pick up. It's harder to maneuver. I rather have a bike that is slightly longer with a bit more air pressure in my tire than trying to lower the pressure, have tire insert, and then reduce my chassis or wheel size to have an easier handling.
Yeah.
To kind of re-loop with the previous discussion, you do understand that all this is basically impacting the way the bike is reacting in between your legs, right?
Yes. Yeah.
It's quite tech and detail, and I hope everyone is enjoying it and picking up what we're saying. And if that's not the case, please feel free to ask. We'll clarify this. Yeah. And sorry for my poor English sometimes.
No, it's good. It's really good. It's super interesting. So would you normally, you would select quite a thick tire casing, basically a thick sidewall tire to offer the support that you want, the resistance, the puncture resistance that you want, and the ride characteristics that you want, but then just put in extra sealant.
Yeah. Not the extra sealant, because I think that the amount of sealant you have put into a wheel based on the tire volume you have will go from 80 to 120 milliliters. So it doesn't affect the tire sealant but it does affect the fact that the tire casing being a stronger one. I do believe in the functionment and the general homogeneity, I'm not sure I can say that, or let's say constant deformation of the overall casing than having a lighter casing with an insert inside. I do prefer to trust the layers that I have through the casing and the rubber than the tires itself.
Okay. And if you were going and racing downhill at a high level again, would you put that insert in from a security perspective to avoid the puncturing, or do you feel you can get where you need to be with tires?
No, I think we can get where we need to be with tires. I think today's with the downhill casings we have, etc. I think we have the possibility to get away with it, even if it's obviously some risk. But I think there is a way to go around it.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Cool. One more thing I wanted to pick up on, and that is social media, because when you were racing, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000, it didn't exist. And now it's such a big thing. It's a massive change. And I'm just wondering what your take on it is, because, yeah, it seems to be an important thing for riders to be on and to have a presence on these days. And it just wasn't there before.
Well, it is great for the sport, because it's actually giving the possibility to make the content we are producing at a larger amount, I would say, spread more naturally and have a larger virality, even to people that are not riding bikes. So this is a fantastic opportunity and a great channel. I'm honest with you that sometimes, from my perspective, it takes a bit too much space, especially on brand and marketing decisions, etc. But I completely understand where that comes from. The thin compromise that there is between athlete performance and social media is not that easy to find. But I would say that luckily, the base of performance is still needed, as much in racing or just pure athlete performance, to actually reach a certain amount of number and become really popular, I would say, through the social network. But I do believe that he plays a real role there for the brand. But also, I like the fact that he makes all the athletes a lot more accessible and close to their fans and show their natural side a lot easier. It's like you can't fake it on social. If you fake it, people can see it. It's at some point, it doesn't reflect what he has to do. And it's just actually showing who people are and what they do. And I'm honest with you that I really like this authenticity.
Good, good, good. And do you think it's important for riders to have a presence on there today? Do you think it's hard to get into one of the bigger teams or to work with some of the bigger brands unless you have a bit more than just your riding performance to bring to the table?
Well, luckily, the performance is actually rising the numbers on social right away due to the great coverage we have with Red Bull now and with the AWS as well. The media that is around it is actually helping the riders just through their performance into the social numbers. So this is the great thing, and that's the base. Then I would say it's the personality of the riders that does the job. I'm taking the example of Loic and Amaury. Like, they are completely natural and completely open. Obviously, their results put them where they are. And on the top of that, they have a great personality that is great and accessible for people. So their numbers go massively high. And I would say that today we can't really see people that are good riders to a certain level not having a very high number of socials on social media. And I would say that it is a base. Now I have to tell you that I'm not a big fan when the brands are choosing, for example, riders into teams due to their social network coverage more than their just pure performance. And I know it is to take in consideration even today in my position. But luckily, we have the chance to have riders that are dedicated to social, and that's where they push on social network, etc. And we can still choose fully based on performance our racers, and this is a great advantage. But I'm saying it's often a combination. It's pretty rare to have riders that are performant without good social network.
Yeah, fair point. I hadn't thought about it like that. Cool. All right, we've got one more question before we hit our four final questions, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But the main thing I want to ask before we go on to those standard four questions is, obviously we've got this virus around now. It's meaning that a lot of World Cup races have been postponed or cancelled. No one really knows at what point we'll be racing again, but at some point we will race again, that's for sure. What do you think it's going to take for a rider to come back from what we've just been going through and win kind of the first season or the first event back? What characteristics do you think are important to enable a rider to do that?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. The situation at the moment is not fair. Not due to any race regulation, but just the global world situation. You have obviously riders in Australia today that are completely open to ride. They can ride. Mm-hmm. They can ride every day. You have Troy and Jack Moyer. So this will be changing in the next days, but they can still ride. When you have people in France like Dimitri Tordo or like Loic Bruni, etc., you're not allowed to ride at all. So obviously, this is obviously making a huge difference on the fact if you can ride or not. But without this problematic, I would say that out of the situation, you will have two type of rider. And that's what I'm saying to mine. I'm saying, well, you have the one that's going to be laying down and waiting to see what's going to be happening. Or you are the one that's going to be proactive and say, well, that's a time that I can make efficient to do things that I normally can't do. Learning new things and training harder and having a different approach and trying things that I didn't have the chance to try due to my normal training and normal season. So let's make this time profitable to have a step or another step ahead than the other. So this is will be massively changed. What we're going to see in the first races is to actually see, number one, the people that have been lucky to ride or not. That would be the first thing. And number two, the one that have been, you're making this time profitable to train and to focus and to do a special work to be able to get back at the highest level. And I'm taking right away one example, that is Tanis Seagrave, that I'm lucky to work with now. And she's putting her rehab very seriously. She's focusing. We did an amazing work all over the winter. She's got injured right before the first races. It was a drama emotionally and mentally. We've managed to transform that and now make it profitable. And she's doing an amazing job to stay focused and on the goals and the fact of being back on the bike. So we all know this logo, this Asian logo, the yin and the yang. Nothing is fully black. Nothing is fully white. There is always a bit of black in the white and the white in the black. And what I'm saying there is that this COVID-19 situation is a drama for a satire point of view, for an economical point of view, but it could be somehow positive to the human being and to the racers. And to take it to a larger scale, I hope that from that situation, we're going to learn. We're going to learn into a world that is going maybe too fast, that is going too wild, control things with a lot more precision into our politics, into our approach of life, into the agriculture, into the proximity with people, into the human relationship with people through communication, social networks. So this is a very wide approach I'm having there. But into sports, it is very similar things. I'm really advising any riders now to take the opportunity to sit down. Why am I riding the way I am? How can I progress? Where can I bring myself? What do I want to do? What are my goals? And this moment of life is actually an opportunity and the positive side of the crisis we are going through.
Nice. I like it. That's a nice place to wrap up. But we'll just hit quickly our four final questions. These are pretty quick. First one, if our listeners had €200 to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
€200 to... So number one, I'll buy a 2.5 tire with a downhill casing and very soft rubber to put on the front.
Yeah.
To make sure that I can optimize my grip and my stability. Mm-hmm. And I spend the other 100 into making my cockpit at the proper width and proper height to have a maximum control. And you will notice one thing into my saying is that I'm only talking about the front of the bike, not about the rear. And the reason to that is that you need to know that it is from the front of the bike that everything is starting. So your hand pressure, the way you load your front wheel and the way you trust your front wheel is one or at least the most important thing when riding your bike. And this starts from the tire you have on the front and from the handlebar wide, the handlebar height and width that you have.
Yeah. And I reckon we could probably do a whole podcast on handlebar width and height. So we're just going to have to get you back because I'm not going to ask you about that now. It's too complicated.
No, but you guys should stay tuned on social network because we're going to come up with a pretty cool through social network as we discuss some pretty cool interaction that we're going to get viewers involved and possibility for them to check what they're actually doing. And I will be able to advise them the way we're going to do it. So if they stay tuned, hopefully we can interact a little further. With
awesome.
This.
Yeah. So where will they need to be for that? Through
my social network, if they go either on Facebook or ideally Instagram, they will pick up the info and this will come up obviously next week, I hope. That everything awesome. Is going to go in it. So yeah, that would be a great opportunity to do so.
That's very cool. Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes for that for sure. All right. Second question: what advice would you give to your 16-year-old self if you could wind back the clock and sit down and have a chat with him?
I would tell him to calm down. When I was 16, that was my second year of racing. I was already pro. And I would say that there was no chance I would not face one of the first 5 trees of each track. I was crashing a lot, committing too much. So if you're 16 and excited about racing, the first thing I can tell you is just be patient. Just wait, build your skills, learn, don't be too excited and time will come.
Good advice. All right. Third question. If you could have a coaching session with anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
That's a good question. Can I make a combo?
Yeah, go on.
So if I could step back in the days, let's say in the years around 2000, so I am 20 years old. I didn't win any world champs, but I'm interested to learn a lot of the things. I would like to have three persons on board. Number one would be Nico Vuyoz for the details mm-hmm. of his approach. Number two was to take the experience of racing from Pete. And the third thing, I would take young Sam Hill to teach me how to corner. Those would be the three guys I would take on board to be able to rise my level.
Yeah. Do you think anyone on the planet can corner like Sam Hill? Because I've never seen anyone else manage it.
No. Sam is unique. Sam is unique and is still unique today. Like the way he corners and the way he handles the bike, he's got skills that are very unique, and we didn't see anyone matching him so far.
Like there and is you're very sorry, go on.
No, I was saying we're really lucky and saw a lot of riders committing and riding fast and amazing races, but the skill he's got and the terrain contact he's got is absolutely unique. And this comes a lot from the geometry and the body position he comes from the bike. Not necessarily only the bike itself, but the position he's got on himself on the bike and what he's looking for.
Yeah, you're a very analytical guy, so you've clearly looked at this. Have you been able to replicate it? Can you get close to what he can do?
Well, I can set up myself the way he is and get this balance, but I never really found a way to be able to handle the bike the way he does.
Yeah, amazing. All right, one last question. What's something that you do every day that you feel benefits you?
At this moment of my life?
Yeah.
At this moment, let's be honest, it's my exercises in the morning. The first thing I do when I wake up is I take a hot cup of water with some lemon and generally some honey, and I go in my little gym room and I get my body to move. I have the unlucky record or unfortunate record of more than 50 fracture through my biking career, I need to get my body some treatment every day in terms of flexibility, movement for my joint to be at best. So this is if tomorrow I have to stop everything, that's the only thing that is for me today a necessity.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Good. I probably need the same. I've not had that many fractures, but my body definitely feels like it has.
Yeah, but I do advise everyone to have this routine. Whatever you do on this first 30 minutes when you wake up is actually driving your day. And if you are capable to have a full day with a lot of water and eating and drinking the right things and get this little body movement in the morning, I'm one of the believer that the body is driving mindset. And if you give your body what it needs right away in the morning, your mindset is good for the rest of the day. So I do invite everyone to do so.
Wise words. All right. Well, we're at the end of our time today, Fabian, but thanks so much. It's been super interesting chatting again. And look forward to hopefully seeing you around at some races at some point in the not too distant future.
Well, thank you for the warm welcome, and for the good time. And please don't hesitate if there is anything, and good luck with all the project coming.
Nice one. Thanks, Fabian.
All right. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you.
All right. That's it for this episode with Fabian. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to PNW Components and Miss Spent Summers for supporting this episode. Don't forget to head to pnwcomponents.com and check out their awesome range, and make the most of being a downtime listener by using the code PNWDOWNTIME at the checkout for 15% off during May. That's PNWDOWNTIME, all one word, all lowercase. Also, don't forget to head to missspentsummers.com and check out their books, merchandise, and wicked selection of free zines to print out at home. Once again, as a downtime listener, you get 15% off everything on their store until the 20th of May using the code DOWNTIME15 at the checkout. That's the word DOWNTIME followed by the number 15, all in lowercase with no spaces. All those links are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. If you've got a couple of minutes spare, then please leave us a review wherever it is you listen to the podcast. Give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast, then share the love at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Don't forget, we've got a Downtime Live coming up too, where you can watch me chat with Cy Turner, the head honcho of Cotic Bikes, and you can watch all of our previous live episodes there too. That's at youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast. Please keep on spreading the word, telling your friends about the podcast, and sharing our episodes on your social media. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, look after each other. And if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride safely.